Sometimes life feels out of our control. We get stuck in trauma, old patterns, and change feels out of reach. Sometimes it feels like fate. We want to help you break out of old, unhelpful patterns and become healthier. We're Fate Resilience, taking control of the outcome.
With licensed therapists, Jennifer Oxford,
Taylor Madsen,
Haley Mayer.
Last time we talked about anxiety. Today we're going to talk about anxiety's big brother, fear. Fear tells us we're in danger.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things to realize is that fear is not always, like, we can talk about different levels of fear. Fear can come small and it starts to creep in ways that we don't realize. And we're going to talk a little bit about that in the fear cycle. But then fear can escalate quickly. And when that happens, it's a different experience than just that everyday fear or those subtle things that have wisdom, right? And we move from having fear that teaches us something's not good for us or something like that into feelings of terror and shock and overwhelmed and flooded.
Mm-hmm. When we begin to feel fear, for each increased amount of fear we feel, a part of the brain will stop receiving blood. So the first place that stops receiving blood is the frontal lobe, the place that's in charge of seeing the big picture, starting a task, following through with a task, ending a task, understanding what we need to start a task, switching between tasks, impulse control, emotion regulation. What else am I missing for the frontal lobe?
Even just options, right? So when we are searching for breaking down the problem and saying, what are my different options? That comes in the prefrontal cortex, where when we move out of the prefrontal cortex, we're in the limbic brain, and the limbic brain is all about impulse.
Yeah. So often the three of us will work with kids, sometimes adults, that have been diagnosed with ADHD, and what they're really dealing with is daily fear that will have them present like they have ADHD. It's just that their frontal lobe or their prefrontal cortex, as you said, Jen, is just not being engaged because they have so much fear in their life. After the frontal lobe, the next level of fear will shut off our neocortex. This is the Spock of our brain. It's just logic and rationality. It's actually a really depressingly small part of the brain. And so if you're like, wow, why did I do that thing? Usually it's easier to identify in other people, like other drivers on the road. Mm-hmm. After that, our limbic system. There's two different areas, sometimes separated depending on which therapist or neurologist you ask. There's the limbic system and the diencephalon. Diencephalon is just fun to say. The limbic system can start to shut down, and it will shut down until it's just the amygdala, just the fear center. And that will push us to do just what looks good or just feels good. And that will be fight, flight, or freeze. Mm-hmm. And for each of these areas that we lose, we'll lose 10 IQ points. The average person has 100 IQ points, absolutely respectable. You can do really anything in life with 100 IQ points. So you can lose 4 areas of the brain to fear, to terror. Then you can lose 40, and in terror, you can lose 50 IQ points. And that would take us down to 60 or 50 IQ points. And the three of us have worked with people that have in the 50, 60 IQ point range. Yeah. One that stands out to me is someone that was extremely diabetic, that in that area, they just didn't know that sugar was bad for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when I've worked with people in that 50, 60 IQ range, one of the things that you realize is they are just impulsive and comfort seeking, and comfort seeking can be in positive or negative ways, right? So sometimes they're comfort seeking, they want to listen to their favorite song over and over again. But when they're in fear, that includes hitting, biting, all of those intense
responses. I'm thinking of that young woman that you first introduced me to.
Yeah. Yes. And so there are times where in that range, gentle, kind, loving, sweet child, like
mm-hmm. She was very much a teenager, but she would,
yeah, physically older, but then it was great. She would give everyone hugs when she was happy and those kinds of things. But then when we moved into her fear, and she probably lost more, right?
She was probably going to single digits, maybe.
Yeah. That she would go into what looked like an animal type response, right? Hitting, kicking, biting, and really not thinking through anything that she was doing.
Well, we call that the reptilian brain, right? We call that, that's just the basic, that's like the oldest, technically the oldest part of the brain is that control center for fight, flight, or freeze. And so it makes it so that when you're talking about, like, it is almost like you would see like my dog who gets upset, because that's just the part that knows fight, flight, or freeze, something's wrong, right? And that fear part, that's when we just resort back to the very natural instinct mode, rather than thinking it through, like you guys are talking about, of cause and effect and what could I be doing instead. That's when, of course, as a therapist, you have to start learning about like DBT processing skills, CBT process, you know, just different things have to be happening there to break out of that. But I mean, you're right. It is the most natural impulse in that moment to make sure that you are safe. And it's about just perceiving even the most mentally unsafe situation has to be perceived almost as a physical threat at that point.
Because it is the oldest part of the brain, all of our sensory information, everything we see, smell, hear, taste, and touch goes through that fear center first, through the amygdala. So before we're able to have a thought about something, we already have a feeling about it, particularly fear. Mm-hmm. And so automatic thoughts from CBT have been disproven for more than 10 years now. We have feelings well before we're able to have thoughts. If you watch exactly where the electric signals go through in the brain first.
Yeah.
And if something causes a fear response and it's a new sensation, we will have a brand new fear connection in the brain. And here's the really cool thing. If you face that thing, that fear, within 24 hours, that connection will be undone as if it never happened to begin with. After 24 hours, we have to do some exposure work to create a new connection that's stronger than that fear connection. So for example, when I was about 8 years old, I almost drowned in the Grand Canyon. But to get out of the situation, I had to get back into the river. I had no choice. Mm-hmm. It was in the Havasupai area, if anyone's familiar with that. So I had to get into the water. I had to swim back out, which I was not looking forward to. I sat on a rock for like an hour and a half. And my mother was very patient, like, come on, Taylor, we gotta go. So to this day, I still love the water. I don't have any anxiety around the water. Now, when I was 9, I had an experience with heights, terrified me, and saw my mother almost die next to a ledge. And I did not face ledges or heights within 24 hours. But I did a lot of exposure work around them, rock climbing, rappelling, but to this day, I still get vertigo and a little bit of anxiety around it. So I had to do that work to make a stronger connection in order to be around them.
I think it's interesting to realize that everybody has their own, I'm going to call it a fear template too. As you get exposed to things and you experience fear to different intensities, what might be fear, like Taylor talking about heights for him, may not be a fear for everyone else. Same thing. Some people think, well, snakes make everyone afraid or spiders make everyone afraid. And that's just not true because people have different templates. I think it is important to recognize that your experiences, it's like putting signs in your brain that your brain wants to remember what it was afraid of because it's trying to protect you. So when you're experiencing flashbacks or flooding or intense fear that seems out of context with what you're actually experiencing, that's the brain's way of trying to help you. And I think too often we say fear is bad versus saying my brain needs to reprocess that fear and it needs to learn something different about it. I want to also mentioned the fawn response. We've talked a lot about fight, flight, freeze, which are very commonly known. The other one that we see a lot in trauma related to relationships, especially, is the fawn response. And this is where, when we are afraid of somebody, we try to make them more comfortable, that by making them more comfortable, we become safer. And I want to bring that up because as we talk about the fear cycle, this comes into personal relationships in a different way.
Yeah. And it comes up in so many different types. I mean, when we think about relationships, we think about the sexual type of relationships, interpersonal with that. And that definitely is the case. And we'll get into that, but it's really an all. I mean, you have that with parents, right? If it's one way or the other, whether it be the parent is scared of the child, you'll see them fawning over them. They're giving them gifts. They're like, oh, please don't freak out. Please, please, please. Because it's out of fear. It's out of fear that that child is going to overdo it, could hurt themselves or someone else. Opposite as well. If the child's afraid of the parent, they're the ones that are, let me go get that for you, or let me do that for you, or anything you say, right? Again, that's not out of a healthy, let me help you because I want to. It's out of a more of a fawning, I know if I do this, then I won't get hurt. I won't get manipulated, whatever it is. You also see that in basic relationships, like with friends. I see it a lot with my teenage kids. If there's someone they're scared about in school, in their friend group, that's the person they're going to be like, oh, you're so funny. You're the best. Oh my gosh. And they're fawning over that person because out of fear. Often the bullies, the people around them are fawning over them because they're scared that they're too going to be bullied. So you see that in so many different dynamics. She does it adult friends, right? There are some people that maybe are very unsafe to us emotionally. And you might see that fawning takes place with those kinds of people as an adult, whether it be your boss, whether it be whoever, because it's out of a fear, not even fear for your safety of your life or fear for your job, but just of this fear of that person holds a power differentiation in some way, whether it be verbally with me because of how they talk down to me, or they physically have a power differentiation because they're above me. There's a sort of fear that happens where you maybe laugh more than you normally would, or things like that, that comes out of this fear. So there's a wide variety of where this fawn comes about. I'm glad you brought it up because it's not something everyone talks about, but it is a more talked about, you know, fourth part of the fight, flight, or freeze response.
I want to add too that fawn is also part of attachment, right? Mm-hmm. So when we have unhealthy attachments, when our needs aren't getting met, some people go to that fawn response. These are our people pleasers out there, right? That you think if I do what everyone wants me to do, then I will get love, acceptance, approval, which are emotional needs and very valid, or even attention, which sometimes we mock as people as attention seekers, but attention is a valid emotional need. And so when we look at fawning, we need to understand that enjoying somebody's company feels very different than the fear of if they don't like me, I want to wear the right thing, I want to say the right thing, I want to do the right thing. And I want to pull in the idea of the fear cycle here. So the fear cycle has three parts. The first one that I'm going to talk about is entitlement. The second one is obligation. And the third one is resentment. So, and I'm going to have Taylor and Haley come in with that, but the entitlement can come into several things. One is our emotional needs are things we feel entitled to, which is why physical safety can move us into fear or terror or different levels. Things like emotional safety, connection will move us into entitlement. Being seen, image management, those kinds of things can move us into entitlement very easily and not out of a negative desire. And I think it's really important to know that when we feel entitled, even though that can be a buzzword for some people, that it is a part of safety versus unsafe and not always about I'm better than you, although that also can play in. The next one is obligation. Obligation is a feeling that I have to do something to get my needs met. Haley brought this up a lot. If I have to be nice to you, if I have to laugh louder, if I have to, again, with trauma, if I have to act a certain way, whether it's to go get you a drink or an abusive physical or sexual relationship, I have to do a certain thing in order to maintain my safety and avoid bigger danger, then that's the obligation. We see obligation a lot in families. Mm-hmm. One of the things we see a lot with obligation is that obligation comes into this point where we feel like the expectation, the family traditions, we all show up for Christmas, we all put on a smile, we all eat this food, we all tell so-and-so they're beautiful, we mm-hmm. all, you know, pretend like we really care, things like that. Where
we don't talk about hard things.
We don't talk about Bruno, that's right.
We make sure everyone feels comfortable and it's a pleasant activity for everyone.
Right. And we lie about how are we doing? Mm-hmm. There's an obligation, right? There's a question we ask all the time. We show up and we don't have any problems. Our kids are perfect, right? And then think about that, the entitlement to have your kids be perfect, the obligation, what's that doing with your parenting in front of other people? Mm-hmm. And then we move into resentment, which is I did this thing to get my need met. Mm-hmm. At an obligation. And now I didn't get my need met. People didn't show up perfectly, or I don't feel as fulfilled as I thought I would. And now I'm in resentment and I'm very upset that mm-hmm. people didn't acknowledge what I was doing and what I was trying to do. Although a lot of it was passively communicated versus directly communicated. And then that goes back into, well, now I'm going to go get it the hard way, right? I'm going to go demand it, or I'm going to go use unhealthy behaviors, addictions, numbing type things to get my needs met.
I think that an important part with it too is that obligation part of it, I don't necessarily think is a negative thing to have some obligation. Sometimes we do have to have some, right? I know with difficult family dynamics, I know personally from difficult family dynamics, whether seeing it or being part of one or whatever is going on, there is a certain amount of obligation to be healthy that we kind of need to take sometimes. But when it has that fear undertone, obligation takes contrast of being in a fear cycle. The hard feelings that come up are resentment. That's when we know we're taking it into a negative.
To distinguish between obligation that's healthy and unhealthy, I like to use the word duty or priority mm-hmm. sometimes. Yeah. I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah.
And one of the things that you can do is even choose it, right? So when there's choice, fear doesn't allow room for choice. That's one of the things that will make our fear rise and move to terror, is we feel like the choice is gone.
It's the only thing we could do,
right?
That's the phrase.
So if I'm doing something out of duty, then I'm doing it out of choice. I understand, I've weighed the pros and cons, and I've made a choice. And that's a prefrontal cortex experience when I've made a choice. So I'm actually in a different part of my brain when I'm in duty than I am in the fear obligation. And so I think, although we call it obligation, and that's going to be something you feel like, yes, I'm obligated to go to work, I'm obligated to make a car payment, right? We're going to use that term. Really, it's a choice. And if you're in fight, flight, freeze, or fawn, you might be seeing it as a obligation versus saying, okay, wait, no, I'm choosing to work because I really want safety and I want those things. And that moves you back, and you can feel that shift in your brain from limbic fear and disconnection to choice and empowerment.
That place where we don't have a choice because of fear really comes with some really funny stories in retrospect. 10 years ago, I was working with a family, and the mom just felt so afraid of her kid that she picked up the pizza she was eating and pushed it into her kid's face and just looked at me so helpless in session and said, what else was I supposed to do? And if you're listening, that might be a funny story for you,
or
you might be
horrified
by it, but that's where it pushes us to go. The part of our brain where choice lives is not online. And when fight, flight, and freeze goes out the window, like we've been talking about, when fight, flight, and freeze becomes unsafe, that's the breeding ground for fawn. Because if we get in trouble for fighting, you know, talking back or using our voice, if we get in trouble for shutting down, like, why can't you talk to me? You look so dumb just standing there. Or you get in trouble for removing yourself from the situation. That's what creates the fawn response. That we're trying to create some measure of control in the situation.
Well, it's back to those dynamics that we'll probably talk in future sessions about, like drama triangle, things like that. We're essentially like a pinball machine, and we're just going to whatever we can hit in that moment, right? Where, you know, fight's not working. Okay, quick, go to flight. Quick, go to freeze. Okay, fawn's the only one left. We got to go there, right? It's not so much because we're calculating it and being like, I like my fawn response, therefore I shall use it every single time, right? We don't turn that switch on and go, that's the one I'm going to use. That's the one in the moment that makes the most sense and is the most safe for us.
And it can be very much learned in family culture, in, like I said, relationships that there are, we talk about with sexual abuse, we talk about grooming and those kinds of things create a fawning response. And so it's something that can be learned, and it's not all extreme. It's not all, oh, I thought I wanted to do it. If we go back to parenting, there for some people, I love that Haley talked about, we can be afraid of our kids and our kids can be afraid of us. The hope is that nobody's afraid of anybody in your family. That would be the ideal. But in working with teenagers for so long, one of the things I see a lot is parents terrified that their teenagers won't love them, that they'll hurt themselves. And sometimes they've even gone as far as to do that and put the parents in a fight, flight, freeze, fawn response with the kids. And to understand that when you're in that place with your relationships is when you really need to seek help and help pull yourself out of it. When you are afraid of your teenager, that means that teenager is also afraid. There's no stable object in that relationship for safety. And so they're already not fully formed with their prefrontal cortex. And as an adult, we're in fight, flight, freeze because we don't want to lose their love, their safety, those kinds of things, which they have control of at that point as they're moving into independence. And so we really need to reach out to a third party and say, how do we gain some stability and structure? And both parties really need it. And then moving them into saying, how do we teach healthy independence versus a fear-based learning of independence?
And then we have the opposite end of the spectrum, where we have parents weaponizing fear for parenting, the threat of harm or using harm. Now, using harm, lots of people see as abuse, but what lots of people miss is the threat of harm, or just making their kids afraid is abuse as well.
And I'll even go one step further and say rejection. If we look at the attachment relationship between parent and child, and we see that again in romantic marriage relationships, the idea that if I do something you don't like, I will lose your love is a big part of fear. And it's part of what keeps us from feeling emotional safety in our relationships. And so there may never have been a threat of physical danger and still be a lot of fear in the relationship. And as you identify that again, doing your own personal work to figure out your attachment style, your needs, how to communicate that, how to identify what was healthy attachment versus what not is something you can really look at, but it plays into how we have relationships.
Mm-hmm. I think an important thing with any of what we're discussing here is just realizing with a lot of these situations, it's not because you're wanting to be a bad parent, you want to be a bad child. It's purely the fact of I'm trying to find my own safety and I don't know how to do so. And that's when reaching out is going to be the most important. If you're finding yourself saying, but this was the only option I had, I think that's automatically a red flag of I got to look for more support. And I think that kind of just brings it back to I've had parents who are like, well, she has to stand with me the whole day and she has to be with me the whole day because there's no other option. She's going to be unsafe or she's going to go and talk to so-and-so who's not a good person. Or I've even had kids come to me and say, well, I have to pay attention to where mom's at because then she's going to do this or then she's going to do that and it's not going to be safe. I think when we start hearing that as in, I now don't have the ability to look at other options and have like a more even way of managing my emotions. Okay, we gotta manage that fear then in that moment. What are we truly afraid of? What are we worried about? And then let's also look at it and say like, that's when appropriate boundaries come into play too. Find a healthy boundary to help me feel safe, but also realize I can't manage someone else. Even if you're a parent to a toddler, you don't say, or the unhealthier way of saying, well, if you don't listen to me, I'm leaving. The healthier option is, oh, you're choosing not to listen to me. Well, I'm going to be over there. When you want to start listening to me, I'm going to be over here. So I'm still here, but I'm going to allow you to make that choice essentially. Because what ends up happening is by saying like, well, if you don't listen, I'm leaving. Then that's that fear that comes up. You can still remove yourself from the situation without needing to check into that fear and use that fear. And that unfortunately has been often one of the biggest things that I have to work on with parents or with teenagers or with, you know, just people in relationships. If we're doing it to entice fear because we feel like that's the only response they're going to listen to, we automatically are not in a great place, not in the sense of we're awful, but in the sense of we're not really tying into our strength there. We're going for an easier picking.
What I love about what Haley said is that if you pull that back and you listen to how do we create less fear in relationships and more healthy connection, the answer is a healthy boundary, mm-hmm. a healthy, what are the value system we're coming from and being able to ground ourselves in that as human beings versus what are the rules?
Yeah.
Rules are important and they are in part of boundaries because they help us understand how to keep groups safe versus just individuals. And when you see rules go away, that's because individuals' safety is being prioritized higher and it's actually putting more people in harm's way versus when we have healthy rules and we understand the values behind them, you're going to start to see reduced fear. Now, when we have rules without values, we see control. And so I think it's really important to understand that rules alone create fear, but healthy rules with values and boundaries that can be discussed and work together, that's going to create more stability and safety for people to explore and learn about themselves and go through their healing process.
That fear undermines our ability to hold boundaries. And if we don't hold our boundaries and we hold to fear instead, that's not based in reality. Because we talked about before, fear can be incredibly healthy and informative. It lets us know when we're in danger. We are afraid that our kids will reject us. We're afraid that our partner won't love us. We're afraid that we'll be alone. And so we'll settle for crumbs. And when we settle for crumbs, and we're afraid that if we don't accept the crumbs, that we'll never get anything, we instead will just continue to starve rather than ever get a full meal.
And I want to add, I love that analogy, Taylor. And as you're saying that, I want to note that sometimes when we're getting crumbs in a relationship, and it may be because we don't have healthy skills, not necessarily people are unhealthy, we turn to crumbs outside of the relationship. We turn to alcohol, pornography, overeating, overspending, numbing ourselves because we don't believe that a healthy relationship is possible. We're numbing the pain of disconnection. Mm-hmm. And that's important to recognize that so that we can move it back to say, okay, if I've got these behaviors, if I've got these addictions going on, the answer isn't to just start white knuckling my pain. It's to start to get my needs met in a healthy way.
Yeah. And just in case anyone thinks that Jen was saying that we're responsible for someone's addiction. What she means is that everyone with an addiction has the core belief that no one will be able to meet my needs.
Correct. Thank you. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what do we do when we encounter fear? What are some ways to work through it?
One of the fastest ways that I've learned, and I actually thought it was really silly when I first became a therapist, but have found it to be very important, is just breath. Breath actually re-engages your prefrontal cortex. So we started by talking about how your prefrontal cortex gets disengaged. So in that moment, as soon as you can start to slow your breath and bring your prefrontal cortex in, you're going to be able to look at a bigger picture. Taylor talked about how that's where the bigger picture is. Removing ourselves from danger is important. Absolutely. If you're in that terror, you have to remove yourself from danger. And then breathing and grounding ourselves. And sometimes grounding ourselves means talking to a safe person or using those coping skills, but really slowing our mind down, which is what fear, it's kind of the antithesis of fear, is we've got to slow down.
Doing silly things that are going to be a little embarrassing can help inoculate you against fear. I personally, when I was a teenager, sang all seven or whatever verses of I Feel Pretty in my school cafeteria.
We don't say you have to do that, but it worked for Taylor.
Would that smartphones existed.
I kind of feel bad I didn't think about that. That's a good one. Radical body movement too. So changing positions, standing up, leaving a room, visually going outside. So if you feel trapped, one of the things that I would recommend is if you can safely go outside and feel the space around you, moving up against, and this is different for different people, finding a solid object, if it's a comfort item, right? If it's crawling under a blanket, those kinds of things. There's a lot of things that starting to gain control can feel like.
There's four classes of coping skills. There's breathing and mindfulness, like Jen was saying. There's physical exercise, the more intense, the more helpful for fear. I obviously haven't done that in a great while. There's changing your skin's temperature. Our brain sees anything happening to our skin, because it's our primary defense, as a priority over anything that it's registering internally. So holding ice, cold shower, cold bath.
The hot tub.
The hot tub, absolutely. Warm water is a little less effective, but still excellent. I will stay in warm water for 7 days and come out like a prune, and it's wonderful. And then the fourth is tactile type of coping skills. So fidget toys, Play-Doh, silly putty.
But you can't, let me just say this because I know my teenagers are going to run with that one. You can't carry that around with you at all times and say, this is my only way to combat fear. Okay. We're talking about when there are extreme fear moments or when you're feeling it come up, those are great resources to have. Unfortunately, I feel like we've kind of changed as a society to say like, well, the need to have it with you at all times, because that's the only way you're going to be able to combat it. This is what we're talking about as like trying to like jolt you out of that fear moment, so that you have the ability to regulate through it. This is not going to be the thing that solves your fear.
And I think the wisdom in what Haley is saying is that if I'm carrying my stuffed animal with me all the time, my stuffed animal is now related to my fear. It's related now to my fear. If I keep one of those bubble pop toys with me all the time, it's going to be now triggered to my fear, versus when I'm afraid, I move out of the situation and I'm using it to ground or to cope. It's the same thing. If we live in our hot tub, that's not going to have the same, but it's the change of body temperature, right? The getting into the hot tub for 10 to 15 minutes, the using the coping skill for 10 to 15 minutes. And that's really the difference, is a coping skill we use for 10 to 15 minutes, recheck in with ourselves, and then move back. More than 45 minutes at a time is actually reducing the effectiveness of your coping skill.
Yep, it takes 45 to 60 minutes for our kidneys to filter out the adrenaline and cortisol that are released when we feel fear, and the epinephrine and norepinephrine, the neurotransmitters in the brain. There are no enzymes in the brain to get rid of those. So it takes 45 to 60 minutes to be filtered out. A well-trained adult brain with coping skills takes 5 minutes to come back online. I want to give two examples of...
I just want to repeat what you said. A well-trained adult mind with a coping skill.
Yes.
An effective coping skill that you've learned to use and you've practiced, because that's very different than taking an adult who has 100-point IQ, who went down to 60 or 50 and saying, here's something you've never used before, you get 5 minutes. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about practice.
Yeah. So it'll take an hour. It took me several months before I got to that 5 minute of daily practice with it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've talked about fear being based in reality and being useful information, and fear being not based in reality and unhelpful information. I want to give two examples. I worked with a young man who had this intense fear that if he got up, walked around, got out of bed, that his stomach would explode and he would die. Mm-hmm. So after doing lots of traditional therapy for 3 months, we had no progress. And so we decided we were going to test that. We got some nurses, we had a doctor nearby. So, okay, let's have a foot race. You and me, let's go run down the hall. It's like, but my stomach will explode. Exactly. That's okay. Look, here are the nurses, here are the doctors. They say that'll be survivable. We'll get you taken care of. I had enough rapport built with him that he trusted me on this.
He also saw you and was like, I'll win.
That is exactly what he said.
Really?
And then he left me in the dust. This kid had been laid up in bed for 8 months and I lost. That is so embarrassing.
And this is why we really appreciate you for all that you are.
Thank you for that vulnerability, Taylor.
And then he was laughing so much that he kicked my butt that he wanted to, and I was winded after the third race, but he kept going. And then the fear was gone and he was fine. He was up walking around after that. Now, fear based in reality, if you are in domestic violence, if you're experiencing abuse, that fear is incredibly important. You will not be able to get rid of the fear because the fear is keeping you alive. So reach out to someone, reach out to us, reach out to a therapist. Let's get you in touch with a safety plan. Let's get you in touch with a shelter.
And I want to just repeat, if you are in reality-based fear, do not overexpose yourself. That is not rational.
Right. You're in the forest. A bear comes out in front of you. I would hope you feel fear. Don't go up and smack it in the face and say, my therapist said this podcast I was listening to said I should expose myself more to fear. Do not poke the bear.
Or if there's a lot of situations too, relationship wise, where you look at it and you say, I'm pretty sure this could be a dangerous situation. I've had individuals in the past that are like, well, I really wanted to know if it really was a dangerous situation though. And it's like, but if your gut's telling you that there is a fear, we're not saying you need to validate that there's a genuine fear that your, you know, significant other is going to do something. You can just trust your gut. Like that fear is okay. You don't need to like say like, how much would I be in trouble if I were to tell him I'm not going to do A, B, and C? Or how much would I be in trouble if I told her I'm not listening to what she said anymore? We're not saying you need to do that either.
And if you're not sure whether your fear is reality based or not, that's something that you can use the therapy for, is to get in touch with what is the reality of it. Because if the irrational fear comes from somewhere, you need to process that. But then reality-based fear, we can help you with resources to safely disengage from the dangerous situation.
Thanks for listening. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Please feel free to rate, subscribe, and review. And if you want to find us on social media, we're on Instagram and Facebook at Fate Resilience. We'd love to hear from you.